Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, as I hope you do every Sunday. And also, as you know, all of our programs are available at all times on our website, even the ones that we have archived. So it's an ongoing living
thing,
roster of people, yes.
Living, breathing, all that kind of stuff.
And exactly.
So are chefs, mostly.
Right. Well, this one, our first one, Daniel Burns, is alive and kicking. He's great.
There's no question about it. And,
yeah.
And he's leading a new movement, aside from the fact that he's an extraordinarily innovative young chef with a great pedigree of chefs that he's cooked with. But he's
had the most interesting background.
Right. But he's leading the way in a new direction. We talked about tasting menus have been the thing of the day forever and ever and ever, it seems, but there were always tasting menus with wine. Daniel believes tasting menus with beer pairings is much more interesting to explore, and he has a partner who deals in beer anyway, who's a gypsy brewer, and together they have made a name for themselves with two restaurants, one in the back of the other, one called Torst.
Yes, that's the beer.
And the one called Laxo, which is in the back.
Luxus.
And they...
Luxus.
Yeah, okay. And just to prove they knew what they were doing, they wrote a book about food and beer. So here's Daniel.
It's not usual for me to be at a loss for words, but I'm struggling a little. We're talking to Daniel Burns, who with Yeppe, can you do the last name, Daniel?
Yarnet Berkser.
Wrote a book called Food and Beer. Some others, Joshua David Stein, and also a foreword by Rene Redzepi. And I get the overall concept, of course, which is that you believe strongly that beer, a curated presentation of beer with food, is very important to do and to break the ties that everybody's had with wine pairings with food. Now, I get that, but when we get past that, this book is so intensely personal, I don't know where to go from there.
Well, yeah, we want the book very much to be a conversation between Yeppe and I, and also Joshua David Stein, the co-author. And we base it a lot on flavors, you know, what's common to beer and food. We talked about flavors, sweet, salty.
Yeah, you had one in there I didn't understand. You had 10 flavors. Maybe you should run through them and explain why you needed to put tasty in there.
Tasty. Well, that was for recipes and beers that we, you know, mostly for the recipes that we just thought were really great and didn't really fit into any other of the chapters, and we wanted to include. And you know, sometimes there's just a tasty beer as well that you can't describe or doesn't fall into any category.
So essentially, now you are a Canadian living in Brooklyn. And,
yes.
Yeah, and you've worked, of course, in Canada and in absolutely stellar restaurants in the United States and the UK and in Copenhagen. Now, your partner, who is really as I gather, he's called a gypsy brewer, beer brewer.
Gypsy brewer, yeah.
Yeah, he is actually Danish, right?
He's Danish, yes.
Yes. And I thought it was an interesting story how you sort of almost accidentally met and led to this collaboration on a double restaurant, I'm going to call it, in Brooklyn, which is, what does Torst mean?
Torst means thirst.
Okay.
And so that's the beer bar in the front with we have 21 taps and about 150 bottles on the seller list.
And Luxus means luxury.
And the beer Luxus means luxury. And that is in a sense a tongue in cheek comment on, you know, in 2016, what does fine dining mean? I almost always think about it in quotation marks a little bit, because it doesn't have to mean the white tablecloths and the French service anymore.
Right.
So perhaps it can exist in the back of a beer bar in Greenpoint. Brooklyn, which is
right.
sort of where the name comes from.
Yeah. Well, now you are a beer restaurant of some significance, though, right? Because
we're the first restaurant to get a Michelin star without having any wine in the building.
Yes, yeah. that was interesting.
That was just something that was pretty cool to get acknowledged for.
So, but anyhow, you kind of present yourselves in, I think, a very open and personal way in the introduction, talking about your backgrounds and how you got to where you are. And then you do a day in the life of, which seems to be something that people really want to know about, how it happens at a restaurant.
Right.
And then you each take 10 flavors that are common to food and beer. And what are some of those now?
Yeah, there's funky, sweet, fruity, smoky.
Bitter.
What else did we put in there?
Bitter.
Bitter, tart, and then earthy. There can be some earthiness. So it's interesting. There really are so many styles of beer. And so we wanted to make sure that everyone was, you know, conscious of how vast the world of beer is. And I think some people perhaps that don't come and try the restaurant or the bar maybe think, oh, I know beer. It's, you know, Miller Lite all the way.
Oh,
to
God,
get,
no.
You know, and it's like, so there's the craft beer movement has just, you know, so many amazing breweries have sprung up, and it's not just a phenomenon that's happening in North America or New York City. It's like quite a global thing.
Oh, everywhere,
Very interested in it. Yeah.
Now, the first part of the book, you really reference your more casual restaurant tourist.
Yeah, that's the bar food menu. All the recipes have been at one point in time on the menu at the bar. And, you know, we wanted to try to create something that was differently from burgers and fries. It lends to my experience from Europe. There's a lot of things that are sort of English pub fare classics. We do a Sunday roast, and there's Welsh rarebit. And then also my time in Denmark, which we make the Danish rye bread. And there's a lot of things that sort of have been influenced from Scandinavia, like cured fish and things like that.
Well, I mean, some of these recipes in your room, you have, I might point out, I better point out now that in your small, more upscale restaurant, you do a tasting menu matched to beers,
right.
And that's the only option. I mean, you don't do bar food. Some of these,
right.
And in that case, you do the recipe first, and Yeppe has to do the match with beer. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's the same as a sommelier would work with the chef. You know, you have to make sure the dish is created first, and everything's dialed in terms of the elements of the dish, and then we can start thinking about the beverage pairing after.
Well, some of these seem a little tough, like beef tongue, artichoke, and fennel. What did you pair with that?
Let's see what that one was.
Jolly Pumpkin.
Remember that.
Jolly Pumpkin.
Yeah, so the beef tongue, did you say Molotov cocktail?
Beef tongue, artichoke, and fennel. And you paired it with La Roja Jolly Pumpkin, or is it ales?
Yes. Yeah, so that... First of all, in terms of the main courses, we try to do something a bit unique at Luxus. Maybe not the beef tenderloin, let's try the tongue instead. And so something also interesting technique-wise, that there's an interesting texture you might not have tried before or things like that. So the Rioja is it's a sour ale, and it's been aged in wine barrels for some time. Those ones are very interesting that, they can take on this sort of natural wine quality to them with the main courses, we've done different ones, lever beer, beer Brunia, that are very much a good introduction to people who, you know, really think they're not that into beer, and it's a good bridge between, because it's, I think a lot of times with the, and ask them to say what it is, and they will say natural wine first before beer. So.
Well, earlier on in this book, though, somebody wrote that sour beers are not good pairings.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they're overly sour, it can be very difficult. It's similar to when you have an IPA with a very hoppy IPA. It will tend to overpower the flavors in the food.
Yeah, we had that the other night.
Certain beers that can be very difficult. So the overly sour ones like Cantillon, a lot of beers from Cantillon, probably meant just to be drunk by themselves for a lot of it.
I think you, well, I honestly can't remember what was served with a sour beer at a beer dinner I went to the other night, but it was undrinkable with the food.
Yeah, they can be so sour that it's just lip smacking almost at times.
Yeah, it's not. I'm a beer lover, but it's not a style of beer I really just particularly care for. But the interesting thing is, tongue as a pairing element has to be really rather flexible because it's almost bland. I mean, it has an intriguing flavor, but it's almost bland.
We marinate it, we brine it for 24 hours first, and then we braise it at a low temperature, and then we roast it. So it gets some char on it also.
Got it.
So
okay.
It's about the charring and the texture of it, and then mix it with a very, very solid, very summery dish is what that's meant to be. Because traditionally you think beef tongue, it's going to be, you know, very heavy, braised, and, you know, probably too tough and things like that, and I'm trying to elevate it to a different thing whereby it can actually just be like a really refreshing salad that has beef tongue in it.
Oh, we like it a lot. I mean, if I'm cooking it, I cook three at a time, and we eat it for a week.
But we like it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we eat it hot. We eat it warmed over. We eat it cold. We eat everywhere you can.
Yeah.
I mean, the recipes in this book are inventive to say the least. I mean, I'm looking at lobster relish and seaweed biscuit.
Yeah.
That sounds
amazing. That's one of the snacks that we do in Luxus, and those are meant to be small one-bite things at the very start of the menu. Uh-huh. When we opened up, we probably did two or three snacks. Now we're up to doing anywhere between six and eight. So that's very much something I took from my time in Scandinavia. That's how the fine dining restaurants do it there. So, you know, you come into the restaurant, you get your first beverage, and then, okay, let's start the sharing. You see all the plates are two on the plate, so it's meant to be served between two guests so they can actually eat off the same plate. And snacks is like potato crisps, you know, you eat it with your hands. So it's all those servings are meant to be with the hands and the lobster relish one is also sort of, lobster has a special place in my heart, you know, growing up in Nova Scotia, we have the good ones up there.
So. Yeah, boy.
You don't send those down this way, huh?
Now, and here's another one that was fascinating, your beef tartare, which is suddenly, you know, to me, that's something I grew up with, beef tartare. Now all of a sudden it's fashionable, and everybody's serving beef tartare and with razor clam. Now, what do you do with your tartare here? I'm always interested in how you modify it.
Yeah, the tartare is something also with the preparation-wise. I don't think when you freeze the meat first and then either slice it or cube it, I think it always has this watery texture that's unpleasurable in my mind. So we always use the tenderloin for the tartare.
Okay.
You know, very, very, very tender piece of meat. And we scrape it with a very sharp knife.
So you hand cut it, actually.
Yeah.
You hand
scrape it by hand. That means that there's going to be different textures just because of human error.
That's great.
Be slightly larger than the others. So texturally, it's very fresh. And we don't age the meat at all. I want it to be very, almost the tartare is acting as the flavor agent for the rest of the ingredients on the dish.
Well, you're one of these, I call them philosopher chefs. I mean, you really think through what you're going to be serving. In fact, didn't you have a degree in mathematics?
And philosophy also, yeah.
And philosophy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think there has to be a story behind the dish. You know, it you can just make something up and then, but if you're actually thinking about things you've tasted before or places you've visited or what time of year it is or how, you know, geographically it can be interesting, then there's more of a connection that hopefully the guests can catch on to. Stories that all of these, I mean, the restaurants I've worked at, all of the, both Heston and Renee talk about childhood memories as inspiration for dishes. And if you can click into that, in terms of the guest experience, then you're really, it can be really world-class things come out.
Yeah. What do you think of Renee's current project, the Urban Farm?
Yeah, Urban Farm. And, you know, they're always, when you reach number one in the Pellegrino list, then there's even more pressure than any other restaurant to keep evolving. And, it's just incredible how creative Renee and the whole team there is. He's had people with him for such a long time that, I always think about his team could, you know, be the crew for three or four top restaurants of the world. That's how much talent he has with him. And, it's pretty incredible what they do.
Did you ever come across
amazing
that?
To be there, you know, back in the growing up periods of the restaurant and to, yeah, just to have worked with him and see how inspiring he can be. And for now, to so many cooks and chefs of the world.
Did you ever run across a young man called Trevor Moran?
Trevor, yes, certainly I have, yeah. We worked together.
Oh, he's good.
He also passed through the catbird seat, which a few of my friends have been head chef there.
We had
Joshua Haberger and Eric Anderson as well.
Yeah, well, he cooked for us. We cover the Nashville Food and Wine thing every year. And last year, he cooked for us at Catbird Seat. And boy, his stuff is right on. I mean, he's really good.
Yeah.
He said he was scared.
He's an incredible guy.
Here's what he said, Danny.
Oh, come on, Robbie.
He told Danny he was scared.
Oh, come on.
He was scared to serve her because he knew she knew what she was talking about. He's still in Nashville.
I think he's actually in Japan right now. He's moved
he's back, but he's going to return
to do something else back there.
That's right.
I really fell in love with Nashville.
Yeah, I talked to him the other day. I have a feeling there might be a young lady in there somewhere, but I'm not sure.
I can imagine there might be. Yeah.
There always is with Trevor. But now, let's talk about desserts. I mean, I don't usually think of beer with desserts, although the other night they did serve beer with desserts. But now you had this experience as a pastry chef. So what kinds of desserts do you gravitate towards, and what kind of beers ended up being paired with them?
Yeah, well, the thing with dessert, everyone might start thinking, oh, you know, let's just do a stout, really heavy, sweet, high ABV stout. But you know, as we talk about in the book, the pairings, there's a lot of different ways to go in terms of philosophy of it. So most importantly, especially with my time having worked at Noma, seasonality must also transfer over to the sweet servings. So right now, there are no raspberries around, so what are you going to use for the main ingredient in the dessert? So in the wintertime, we lean towards the root vegetables like parsnips and carrots.
Rhubarb, fennel, and matcha. And you know what? Yeah. People might think that that's an odd combination. And I looked at that, and I thought it was absolutely the most reasonable and on-target ingredient list for a dessert.
Sounds a little bit like a poor man's Viagra, too.
Why would you say that?
Because that's what matcha's supposed to do that.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, that's one of the things it's supposed to do, in Peru at least, anyway.
That was the dessert from last year at this time, the rhubarb dessert. And, I sort of, you know, I'm not so sure I keep up on all the trends in terms of what's popular in food, but, the matcha, I guess, was a very trendy thing at that time. So I sort of stumbled upon it somehow. But, rhubarb is one of my favorite ingredients for dessert. You know, it adds such nice acidity. And the most important is that in tasting menu format, there must be a progression. There must be some way that the guest is following along a story in terms of the flavors. And so we do a palate cleanser every menu, which is quite just two bites of sorbet that awakens the palate and cleans out the flavors from the main dish before you enter into having the sweet, the final sweet thing. So, so in terms of the pairing though, perhaps the dessert is a little bit sweet, and then what are you going to do with it? Maybe have slightly sour beer or something that calls out, one of the lesser ingredients of the dish to speak towards it. Which is something that's been really interesting for us to explore. If it's a carrot dessert, maybe you don't do a beer that has carrots or added in. Maybe you do something that, maybe there's cumin in the dish, so you do something that will speak to the cumin as opposed to the main ingredient.
Yeah, and here you have sunchoke, malt, and thyme. That's a stretch, isn't it?
Yeah, roasted sunchokes is very sweet. I don't know if you've ever roasted them.
I grow them. It's a weed in my backyard.
They start caramelizing almost immediately.
You can't get rid of them in my backyard. You can't dig them up.
Yeah, there's so many cool things you can do with it. I think sometimes raw can be a little bit much, but roasted and pureed, it's very interesting things to be done with sunchokes.
You like licorice a lot, don't you?
I do, and it's something that, you know, I didn't grow up with. I tasted it for the first time in Scandinavia, but I definitely lean towards it as a malt and licorice and also beetroot, things that remind me of my time in Scandinavia.
Right.
Now, here's a piece of information that I'm sure you'll find totally useless, but the Queen Elizabeth II has a standing order for licorice from Tropea in Calabria. She loves it.
No way.
Yeah, it's the root.
Awesome.
It's the real root.
Yeah. The
And have you tried the very salty licorice from Scandinavia, from Denmark and Sweden?
No,
I haven't tried that.
I grew up in England where what you do with licorice is you make it into a candy, a sweet.
Oh, right, yes.
Called licorice all sorts, or if they're smaller, they're, I forget what they call, they have a different name for it. Hundreds and thousands, I think they're called.
Yeah, but right. I think the most interesting use of licorice that I've ever had was at Le Calandre in, where is it in Italy? It's near Padua.
Near Padua, yes.
Yeah, and anyhow, they served a risotto with Parmesan cheese on top and grated licorice root from Calabria.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that interesting?
It was a wow.
It was a wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, now, you indicated in your introduction a certain yearning, things didn't kind of work out the way you wanted. You had things that you needed to feel that you weren't feeling. Are you now with these two restaurants, are you settled and content with where you are in your career and in your personal life?
I always thought I would go back to Europe to do the restaurant, and things sort of serendipitously happened by meeting Yeppe and having this project come together so smoothly, actually, and to be one of the owners, it's in so many ways a dream come true to have a small 16-seat restaurant and a successful beer bar that I can come to every day. I live very close by, and it's in the big city, you know, it's in New York, and we're successful, and in so many ways it's just everything I could ask for. I'd also, you know, want to do other things. I'd love to do gelato shop. I love ice cream and all of the wonderful frozen products that can be made, and so that's sort of something I'm thinking about next as well.
There's a fabulous gelateria in London near the Windmill Theater, owned by Jacob, what's his last name? He has an Italian restaurant on one side of the street, and a gelateria on the other side of the street.
What's his name? I can't remember that.
I think it might be Kennedy. Jacob Kennedy?
Something like that.
Sounds about right.
It was at my time at the Fat Duck. You know, Hessen's famous for the bacon and egg ice cream and sardines on toast, sorbet, and all these things just really blew my mind as to what could happen in that realm. And I've just been loved everything about it ever since. And then, you know, during my time at Noma, Renee had very unique ideas about textures of ice creams and sorbets, and So I got challenged a lot in terms of what needed to be produced for the dishes there. So I've had a lot of different experiences with it. And I think there's something innate, like maybe like mathematics, whether, you know, you have a good natural talent for it or not. Otherwise, ice cream making can be incredibly difficult because it's all about the textures of the, you know, is there ice crystals in it? Is it runny? Is it not nice and mouthfeel and things? So I don't know if you've ever seen, you obviously have seen the Gray Noma book, but the carrot snowman dessert is quite a famous one. And that was a real interesting thing where I had to make a carrot sorbet that could be tempered. Basically was frozen. And
that was yours.
That was okay. The recipes I worked on. And I was encapsulated in yogurt gel. So basically you had to temper the sorbet without it melting so that you could slice it, the snowman, all the way down the middle and it would break open nicely and be able to be enjoyed.
Everybody in modernist cuisine seems to be moving on to this new thing. Heston's talked about it to us for probably 12 years. It's neurogastronomy, where they control all the conditions surrounding your experience with eating. And I think that Grant Achatz is moving in that direction with his new iteration of...
emotions and stuff, yeah.
Yes, and I'm wondering, because we have also a new concept that's going to come out of Noma when he opens it. What is your feeling about this, emotions of gastro? It's neurogastronomy, they call it.
Well, I think I haven't had that many experiences with it, but, you know, the sounds of the sea dish that Heston did many years ago now.
It is a long time ago.
It just works. You know, if you're eating a dish of seafood and you're hearing the ocean waves bouncing in your ear, then it obviously enhances the depth of flavor of the seafood. So it certainly can be very effectively used, and creativity of the chefs like the people who are working on stuff like that can only be, you know, a whole other arena for things that can be possible in terms of what flavors your brain recognizes when you taste food.
I guess it depends on how good the flavors are.
Peter's
motioning to me that it's time to wrap it. We have another interview coming up, which actually has to do with ice cream. Somebody who sources ingredients from all over the world, different terroirs.
So we're going to serve a black and tan with the ice cream.
nice.
Anyhow, Daniel, it's really great talking to you, and much success.
Please, so give me an email when you're coming out this way.
Great.
Absolutely. Look forward to that. Have we changed your mind, sweetheart?
We will when you get here. It's all right.
I'm sure we will have a wonderful time. And Daniel, it was fun talking to you. And say hello to your gypsy friend.
I will for sure. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Ciao, Daniel.
Cheers.
Well, you know, I mean, it's the whole pairing with an alcoholic beverage or a non-alcoholic and a mixture of is expanding. I mean, we've had seafood paired with what did we have it paired with?
Well, we had paired with grappa one place.
Well, I was going to say we had it with sake. We had seafood with sake which was very good,
which is very sensible.
And we actually did the whole luncheon with the Noninos, where every course was paired with grappa.
Anyway. Here's the deal. We're going to bring you back an in-person commentary on a menu at
Luxus
in a few weeks' time. So hang around for that, because Anne decided she's going to hand in her badge and she's going to pair with beer, just like she's supposed to, because that's what they do there. And we're going to have a great time, I'm sure, and we'll bring you back a report, of course. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, next up, I mean, we're going to have to now go to Los Angeles because all these restaurants are opening there, including one by our next guest, Jessica Largy, who she's such a talented chef. That
how cool is it to have a cook for you 2 days in a row?
Yeah.
One night at Intro in Chicago, which is where she was posted until just a few days ago. And
then at the award ceremony.
Where she cooked an abalone dish that was just, well, just a little bit shy of heavenly. This is a young lady to watch. There's no doubt about it. She's already been a James Beard Rising Star chef. Don't be surprised if Best New Restaurant in 2017 turns out to be a restaurant called Simone in Los Angeles. And in the meantime, here's the opportunity for you to hear a very composed young lady talk about what it's like to be a chef, why she does it, and so on.
Jessica Largy, you have such a wonderful resume, working exactly at the right places with wonderful people. You've come a long way, and we interviewed you last year at the James Beard Awards because you were a rising star chef, right?
Yes, it was. It was a year ago. I can't believe it's gone by so quickly.
Yeah, well, you're 30 now, aren't you?
The other thing that was astounding, Jessica, is at that time you said, by the way, I'm not a Manresa anymore, or at least I'm about to leave. And that was sort of something of a shock to the system. But then you don't mind administering shocks to the system, and perhaps you can go on to explain why.
Yeah, my leaving Manresa had been planned for a while, and I was there for 6 years. I gave it a lot, and it was time for me to move on and move towards doing my own project. And the timing of the James Beard Awards was just kind of the icing on the cake of leaving there, and I really love that restaurant. I had an incredible experience there, and I'll always consider it my home. And to be able to leave there and a week later win a James Beard Award was beyond anything I could have imagined. It was really wonderful.
Yeah, well, I'm totally in love with David anyhow, Kinch.
Yeah.
So, but this year you cooked at the gala, but we had a chance to sample your food otherwise as well. We went to a restaurant called Intro of the Let Us Entertain You group, which is an unusual concept. They invite chefs in. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so it changed a little bit when I got here, but before the premise was to invite a rotating chef in every 3 to 4 months, and they would completely take over the restaurant. And after they went through the fourth chef, they really had a great rapport with Steven, and they ended up hiring him on to be the executive chef of the restaurant. So now, me coming into this, it kind of shifted a little bit, and it became us sharing the kitchen. So he'll always be there and be kind of the person leading everything and organizing and facilitating everything for the rotating chef. So it added a lot more stability, and
yes.
I think they're always evolving at this restaurant. You know, it was L2O, then it became Intro. They've been trying to navigate and figure that out, and I think that they decided that this was the best course to take and the best decision. And so my being here has been a really interesting, another round of figuring it out. But I think we did a great job, and I've had a wonderful time.
So this space was L2O before that, right? That was Lorraine Grass, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was built as L2O. So we're very lucky because we get to have the L2O kitchen, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Well, the L2O dining room is pretty fancy, too.
It is, yes.
So it's altogether a pretty swanky place.
And
that cute little sushi bar tucked behind the kitchen is kind of surprising, too.
Yeah, so that was the private dining room for L2O, and when Intro started, it was sitting empty most of the time, and they decided they could use that space to do another concept. So Sushi opened right before I got here in January, and it's what they like to call their sushi speakeasy, because you have to because you walk through the kitchen and it's kind of hidden, and I think it's a fun concept.
Well, now we're going to talk about two things next. One, I think that we should mention that you were there long enough at Intro to develop some signature dishes, and if mm-hmm. you could talk, I'll mention what we had, and you could probably elaborate on that to give people an idea of your style of cooking. And then I want to jump ahead. You were going to be leaving there momentarily and opening your own restaurant in the Arts District at Los Angeles. Let's
yeah.
start with your signature dishes. We had, let's see, we started out with chickpea frites. And
yeah, that's actually one of Stephen's dishes.
Oh,
the
it
chickpeas.
Is? Okay. Well,
yeah.
Yours are in red. And so,
yes, they are in
okay.
red.
Okay. And so I had your scallops.
Uh-huh.
And caramelized sea scallops, which were delicious, with, I honest to God, never in my life thought of kohlrabi as something I would want to eat. I mean, I think of it that you stick it in a stew in the winter because you need something. And tarragon,
yeah.
crispy potatoes, kohlrabi salad, and tarragon with caramelized sea scallops was pretty special.
Yeah, so for me, that dish, I wanted to do something that was very savory and very, I don't know, inviting in the winter time, because it is different for me to be here in a very serious winter versus my California winters that are pretty much, nothing's really different. It's a little bit cooler, but that's all.
Yeah, I know.
So, yeah, so they were getting great scallops in here, and then I love doing just simple, you know, cooked, smashed, fried potatoes. I think they have a great flavor. It's that reminiscence of something so indulgent as French fries, you know, but it's a little bit nicer and it's less fatty and all those things. And then the kohlrabi, I love making like quick slaws. I do it all the time at home and I love eating them. And I think kohlrabi has such a great texture and it really holds up to acid. It'll break down to become the texture that it is on the dish where you can form it and kind of twirl it into a pile because we cut it very thin, but uh-huh. it still has that great crunch to it. So I thought it was a great way to add something very fresh and light to it. And it is a different preparation than how most people eat kohlrabi. So I'm glad
yeah,
that I
sure.
convinced you otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, I may add that I do one of these slaws with, fennel, celeriac, green apple and sliced olives with a
oh, that
lemon
great.
Yeah, with lemon vinaigrette, and it's good.
No, we did yeah. steal the recipe from Lydia Bastianich.
Well, I modified it though. I modified it totally.
No.
Yeah.
And the other is steak tartare that we had. It was another one of your dishes.
Yeah, so the steak tartare, we were going into spring. And I had been talking to the kitchen about doing some longer projects like fermenting and things like that. And one of my favorite things to ferment is carrots. So I actually take rainbow carrots and baby carrots and ferment them in carrot juice with wakame seaweed. And it's a lacto fermentation, so it's just 2% salt. And then we age them until they're ready, which is usually 1 to 2 weeks, dependent on – it's kind of different with every batch. And it was something really cool for me to teach the kitchen, but it was also a flavor I really love. And then when I was trying to conceptualize something to do with it, I had just had a tartare, and I love steak tartare, and I love the brininess of capers and all those things. And
yeah,
I
me too.
Thought we can do it and make it much lighter and fresher and more citrusy and more bright if we do it with the fermented carrots. And there's just some shallots and chives. And then we take the juice from the fermented carrots that's really bright and acidic and emulsify it with olive oil. And it actually looks and has the texture of egg yolk, which was kind of a surprise.
Oh, yeah.
And so that ends up being what binds it, and it also lends more flavor to it. But I liked that it had all the components of the egg yolk and the sour and the saltiness and everything, but it actually doesn't have any egg in it, and it actually is very light and clean. And then the crackers, the olive crackers, were something that I just really wanted to work on. So
they're really good.
I think that we've tried a few different rye flours for it, and we found this one that just the crackers are great. I mean, in the kitchen, we jokingly call them olive wheat thins because they came out really consistent, and I think that they're great with the brightness of the tartare.
Now, you like surprising touches, and even in something as difficult to cook in as the gala reception of the James Beard Awards, you had a really wonderful surprise with the abalone. You can explain how you fixed it. I thought the crowning touch was that you put a little pickle on top.
Oh, yeah, the pickles came out great. So that was a dish I did here, and it was definitely one of my signatures at my time in intro. And so I braised the abalone and then braised shiitakes in that abalone liquid to have a more contrasting texture. Then we made a black vinegar and brown butter aioli that we tossed that in. Just some toast that was a really great bread that I found here that's brushed with beer. When it's
beer.
Baked, so it has kind of, so it has like a bitterness, and it really lends to the crust of the bread, which I like. And I also put avocados on there, and those avocados are actually from my parents' backyard.
Oh, no,
they have one giant tree, and it produces thousands of fruit. It's really an anomaly. It's very old, which I think is why the avocados are so great, because the tree passes a lot of its oil into the fruit. So they're very creamy and buttery. And when I was at Manresa, we used to buy them from my parents to serve at the restaurant. And then they've actually been shipping them to Chicago the whole time I've been here. And for the gala, I had to call my dad and say, I need 70 pounds of avocados.
70?
And he did it. And he sent all the avocados. And I actually had some extras that I gave away to chefs at the gala. Andrew Zimmern was one person who was walking around with his the whole time. It was pretty funny. Yeah, and then the pickle that you mentioned, it's so I take cucumbers, and usually when you pickle or when you do anything to cucumbers, they'll leach a lot of liquid. And one technique I found to helping with that is I char them. I cook them really hard and hot and then salt them and let them sit, and it kind of like holds the moisture inside of them, and they're more broken down, so they absorb any pickling liquid really easily. And then I made a pickling liquid with some of the sushi vinegar from Naoki Sushi that was seasoned with yuzu juice. And so they have like a really bright, salty acidity to them, and I thought that really pulled everything together.
It sure worked, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's jump ahead. You're leaving in like a week or so to open your own restaurant in Los Angeles in the Arts District. This has to be a great jump forward and up for you. Tell us about it, the name, the concept, and what you're going to be planning on.
Yeah, I'm very excited, and I actually started working on this project before the James Beard Awards last year, but I took off 6 months from cooking and from working altogether, which thankfully my partners were very supportive about, to travel and to take time to myself.
So yeah, I heard that. I mean, I read that you did, but I didn't read where did you travel?
I traveled a lot in California in the Bay Area because I knew I was going to be leaving. So I did a lot of hiking, and I went all over around there. I did some extensive hiking in Yosemite and Marin and Big Sur, all over. And then I actually headed to Europe for 10 weeks, where I went to Copenhagen, Stockholm, Berlin, Amsterdam, Geneva, the Rhone Alps, Paris, and then I ended up spending 3 weeks in Barcelona to end the trip, and it was really wonderful.
I love Barcelona. Absolutely love it.
So the project in L.A. is, the name of the restaurant is Simone, after Nina Simone, who I'm a big fan of.
Yeah, you said you thought of it when you were listening to her music or something.
Yeah, I spent about 6 months trying to figure out a name, and it was very important to me. And one day I was cooking and listening to Nina Simone, and it kind of hit me. And I just thought, like, that's it. It's a name I love, and it has a lot of positive recognition for me. And then I wanted to know what the word meant. And the meaning of Simone is one who listens. And I thought that's pretty wonderful, because I'm trying to have a lot of intent and purpose in building this project. And so I thought that was a really great – that was almost better to me than the connection to Nina Simone. So – I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, I mean, Simone to me means like French retro kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's not your intention. And now you explained a little bit. Maybe, how are you going to make people understand that it means to listen?
I don't know. I mean, hopefully they'll get it from their experience at the restaurant. But if not, that's fine. I wanted it to have meaning to me. That was what was really important. I wanted to really be proud of it and happy with it, and something that's going to be very synonymous with my name. So I wanted to really be connected to it.
Now, your partners, tell us about those. I mean, do they have an influence on the concept?
Yeah, I mean, we're all working very collaboratively. You might have met my one business partner who will be running the front of the house was here at the gala with me, which was really fun to have him out for that. His name's Bruno Bagbeni, and he's the one who sought me out and brought me into this project. And he and I have never actually worked together, but we've worked with a lot of the same people, and we've even worked at some of the same restaurants, but at different times, which
Fine.
I think is really interesting. We've never crossed paths before, though, which is remarkable. But he's incredible. He brought me into the project. He's really my champion, and I couldn't have asked for a better partner to run the restaurant with. And our other partner is a very good friend of Bruno's, but also a big supporter of restaurants, and he eats out all the time. He's a movie director. His name is Joe Russo, and he just directed Captain America Civil War. And
oh, wow, that's a biggie.
Big productions, yeah. But he's also, he's great, and he's actually from the Midwest. He's from Ohio. And so being out here, I've really loved it because I think the people in Chicago are great and very down to earth, and it's a lot of the things that I connect with him, and I feel very blessed to have them as my partners. It's a really beautiful collaboration that we all have together, so it's really fun.
Now, you have an old building that you're moving
into.
We
do.
Tell
us
about
that. Which was the main deciding thing to go to the Arts District is we found this incredible building. It was built in 1909, and it was a factory, and we've been trying to find out more information about it, but I think it was probably empty for a while, for some period of time when downtown was pretty intense and you didn't really go down there that much. And in the 80s, this photographer named Don Miller bought the building, and he completely retrofitted it and built this incredible advertising photography studio downstairs, and then he had a living space upstairs that was both remarkable, very technologically advanced for the time.
Really?
Brought in a really renowned architect to do all of it. It was really stunning, very outdated at this point, but also, like, you could see the intent and the purpose of everything, and it was just a beautiful space. And so we found it, and we were actually working on other locations, and once we found this spot, we just knew that it was the right one. So we moved forward fast, and we secured everything, signed the lease, got it all going, and now we just started demolition this week. So it's really exciting.
Now, you're doing something with meat downstairs in the dark room.
There's about four dark rooms in there, but one of them is built into this, like, brick cellar room. There's two cellars. One is going to be a wine cellar, and one's going to be a butchery room. So it'll be really easy for us to build it into a temperature-controlled environment because it already stays around 60 degrees just because of the insulation of the brick. And so we're going to build this cold room where we can do all of our fish butchery and all of our meat butchery and everything in there so the proteins stay as intact as possible, and I'm really looking forward to that. So.
And you're going to have a rooftop garden. I mean, L.A. is perfect for that.
It is, yeah, and it's really important to me to be able to grow the flowers and the small greens and all the things that I became accustomed to at Manresa, the really special stuff that I want to take the care to grow and have on the menu that I can't necessarily find at a farmer's market. So it's not going to be a huge garden, but it's going to be enough for me to grow as many flowers and sprouts and herbs as I want. So that's what I really want to have.
Yeah, we were always so impressed by Love Lady Farm.
Love Apple.
I mean, Love Apple.
Love Apple Farm. Yeah,
yeah,
pretty amazing.
I get that confused with Love Lady Apples. Love Apple Farm. She's great.
Yeah.
She's great.
She is. Cynthia, she's wonderful.
Cynthia, I've never seen such tall heirloom tomato plants in my whole entire life.
Yeah, that's her specialty. It definitely spoiled me on tomato.
Oh, yeah.
So this, Jessica. You don't know what the menu is going to be yet because you may not open yet this year, although I'm sure you'll try. But let's suppose that we were making a reservation and we were going to come tomorrow. What kind of things would we have, if you like, contrasting them with what we might have had before at Manresa or at Intro?
So, real quick, I didn't get a chance to explain the concept, I just realized. So, it's actually going to be a bit of a dual concept. So, in the main dining room, it's going to be more casual and a la carte. very produce focused, but also, you know, some great meat that I'm going to source and some great seafood. It'll be kind of a little bit of everything. And then in the kitchen, we've built a 6-seat counter where I will cook a tasting menu personally right in front of 6 people for probably only 3 nights a week, so I can be focused on the kitchen the other 2. But I want to be able to have kind of the best of both worlds, do my fine dining, draw on my Manresa and Providence past, and then also have a big bustling restaurant where you can come in and just have a couple things, or you can have an extensive dinner, whatever you like. I just really want to build a restaurant that I would go and eat at all the time, and that offers a range of experiences to the diner.
So. We're there, Jessica. As soon as you open your doors, we're there.
Yeah. Have you?
Oh, great.
Have you ever heard of or met a chef called Trevor Moran at Catbird Seat in Nashville, Tennessee?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Because what you're doing there sounds a lot like what he does for all of his diners.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Now,
he's
off
gone.
Now.
We've lost
track of him.
He's going back to Copenhagen to work with Renee, who we worked for before.
But we lost him. In the meantime, we lost him. We'll have to see if we can't track him down again.
Can't find him. Anyhow, it was a delight meeting you. I'm as excited about your new restaurant as you are almost.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it, and I can't wait for it to all come to life.
Well, if I don't see you before, I'm sure I'll see you again next year at Vood's.
Yes, I hope so. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jessica. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, the dining public seems to have a passion for Mexican food that's insatiable, so we do get quite a lot of Mexican cookbooks. Our next guest stands out in that she has presented not only the classics, but also updated, more contemporary, and naturally lighter takes on some Mexican cuisine. So let's listen to our discussion with Patty Ginich. Patty Ginich is a very, very busy lady. And now you have this cookbook, Patty, A Mexican Today, New and Rediscovered Recipes for Contemporary Kitchens. So we're thinking authentic, but updated, and you put personal twists. Right?
Yes, I think so, too.
Right. Now, you were born and raised in Mexico.
I was born and raised in Mexico City, and then I moved to the U.S. when I got married, which was more than 18 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We moved to Texas first, and then a few years later, we moved to the D.C. area. So then we moved to the D.C. area, and we've been here ever since, and I've been cooking Mexican food since then. And, you know, I've seen how food has evolved south and north of the border, a really fascinating evolution.
Yes, well, you refer to Mexican cuisine as fusion cuisine, which it is, isn't it?
Yes. I think if the term had existed in the 16th century when the Spanish arrived, you know, in Mexico, and then we started having big immigration waves from Asia and Europe and Lebanon, one could say that most of what is considered traditional food today would be called fusion.
Yeah, I mean, you have a whole bunch of recipes on pizza. I never thought of pizza as Mexican.
Well, that is the irony, that if you go to Mexico, either a small, tiny little town or a big city, like the huge Mexico City, which is my small hometown, you will find that right next to a taco stand, there are hot dog carts and hamburger carts, and there's not one town that doesn't have a pizzeria. So some people complain about what happens to Mexican food north of the border, and I always say, you should go down south and see what we're doing with your American classics.
You know, of course,
that's a nice way of putting it.
But it's a lot of it depends on the people who go there, and they expect certain things, which are not always the true cuisine of Mexico, right?
Right. I mean, that is the thing. Many people say, and people are questioning, what is authentic? And I think the terms have evolved severely in the past 10 or 15 years, because you can find just as an authentic Mexican food here in the U.S. as you do in Mexico, with all the Mexican communities and Mexican ingredients. I'm right here.
Oh, good. Now, you have some very important positions, like the resident chef of the Mexican Cultural Institute in D.C. That sounds very important. And a member of the Smithsonian's kitchen cabinet.
Yes.
And you also were the guest chef for the president's Cinco de Mayo celebration.
Yes.
So, I mean, you have a big following. So you really have a lot of influence on our take on Mexican food.
I mean, I think that there are many people out there like me. You know, thankfully, there are a lot of Mexicans that are in the world of food here in the U.S., and I think that the more, the merrier, and people can learn about different variations and different takes and different ways. I think one person really can't handle it all, but I'm very happy trying to share, you know, as much as I can.
Well, then we interviewed Alex Stupak about his book Tacos.
Yes.
And yeah, and it's thorough. It is a very thorough book. Although I'm not sure how many people actually would start dealing with masa as a starting off point for cooking Mexican.
Yes, I think that it used to be very hard to find good fresh masa before, and now there's a mushrooming of tortillerias, not only in California or in Texas, but you are seeing them in New York, and there's Chicago, and so people can get their hands on fresh masa in many different places, and it's very easy to make your own masa at home because you can use masa harina, you know, the corn masa flour that comes ready to be used if you just add water at the store. So I think that's why you see not only people going out to eat tacos at restaurants, but people are starting to hold taco nights, and there's a Taco Tuesday at home.
Yeah, well, I love them, and we have one in Pittsburgh that's T-A-K-O, which also means octopus in Japanese. And so they do global tacos, including my favorite one, which is the octopus one.
Oh, my gosh, I love octopus.
Me too.
I think it's one of my favorite ingredients. I adore octopus, and I think it is so exquisite. It has such an interesting texture. And so, yes, you can find tacos of everything. I was traveling with my husband and my boys last summer. We were in Scandinavia, and they had deer tacos and whale tacos.
What, really? Oh, wow.
All different kinds of tacos.
You know, I have tried nopalitos. I don't understand the attraction. I don't think it has any flavor or anything.
Which ones?
The nopales.
I think it's, you know, it's so very interesting because there's so many things that people can try. And I think that the American appetite is really opening up these days, which is a great thing.
Uh-huh. But, I mean, what is the attraction of the cactus leaves?
Oh, the cactus. You were telling me the cactus. The cactus is really a fascinating ingredient. In Spanish, it's called nopalitos. And I actually think it's going to be the next big thing for vegetarians. I hadn't heard you right. I adore nopalitos. Nopalitos are full of vitamin C, and they have so much fiber. And in Mexico, they're not only the symbol of Mexico, because you see them in the Mexican flag. You know, there's the eagle that's standing on top of the cactus plant eating a snake, and that's like the symbol of Mexico. And you see them in paintings and murals, and every Mexican eats cactus. It has a fascinating taste. It is an acquired taste. It is something that you have to grow to love. But once you love it, you adore it. It has a taste that's very similar to green beans. It's like a cross between green beans and limes, asparagus. It's very toothy. You can grill it, you can steam it, you can boil it. It's so versatile, and I love its taste. I think you should give it another try.
I'll try another. Maybe using your recipe might help.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned mac and cheese Mexicano, right?
Yes.
You said anybody who tastes that will never go back to the other American style.
They will never go back, and I think it is one of my most popular recipes. It was part of my last season on PBS, season 4, and we had so many requests for it. And imagine a mac and cheese that has the cheese sauce enriched with not very spicy but really flavorful. And then I add chunks of crisp bacon and zucchini and corn, and it is just, it's really tasty.
I like the idea that you said that there's never anything like bland like rice, that Mexicans take their sides very seriously.
Very seriously. For us, the sides have to be as important and as flavorful as the main dish. And we have so many ways to cook beans, so many ways to cook rice. We adore pasta as well, and so many different vegetables that you now find. There's the nopalitos, there's the chayote squash, there's the squash blossoms. We do so many things with corn. So when people think about Mexican food being just, you know, in jail with what you will find in Tex-Mex restaurants, they're so surprised when they learn that there are all these ingredients and dishes and new things to play with.
You know, I love that when you were first married, you couldn't even cook. Now look where you are.
I could not scramble an egg. I could not.
Well, you know, you talk about Mexican food being fusion. You're something of a fusion individual, since I don't remember if it was your father, your parents, or your grandparents emigrated from Austria.
My maternal grandmother was from Austria, yes.
And so you have a strong tradition of pastry in your background, too.
Yes, yes. We love pastries. And my grandmother's sister opened up the first Austrian pastry bakery in Acapulco.
Yeah,
and
I saw that.
It was open
yeah.
for decades. Yeah, and she used to make all those delicious pastries and the Sacher Torte and the apple strudel and all the dumplings and cookies, but she made them with the Mexican ingredients. So she used Mexican cacao and true vanilla and true cinnamon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those cakes and pastries really, really took a nice Mexican spin.
Well, you know, I love this meringue dessert that reminds me very much of a pavlova, except on steroids, because you have them stacked, the meringues.
Yes.
That looks so luscious.
Yes. So what happens is I grew up in Mexico eating small meringues. You know, we have just as much French influence, a Spanish influence, because, you know, we had
Maximilian
Emperor. Yeah.
Yeah,
so we love crepes and meringues, and many Sundays my parents used to take us to this bakery that had these individual meringues, and I loved them. My mom, we used to whip heavy cream, and then we would add all sorts of berries. And, you know, I have 3 boys, so I tend to do things not so delicately in my kitchen. So instead of doing the little, you know, individual ones, I decided to just stack it up and make it a gigantic cake, and they love it.
Now, this is from a while back. We used to frequent a Mexican bakery in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And there were these cookies that I just fell madly in love with. I'm not sure how to describe them. I think in retrospect that they were probably pretty simple sugar cinnamon cookies.
Canelitas.
What were they?
Canelitas. We call them canelitas.
Do you have a recipe for that in here? I didn't see it.
I don't have a recipe for that in there. There are so many Mexican cookies.
Well, I mean, I was so serious about these cookies that Peter had a colleague who used to air freight them to me, frozen.
Oh, wow.
And I called them, the shape of them, I called them alligator cookies.
That is so funny.
But I could never find a recipe for them.
I will help you find a recipe. I love it when people ask me for things that I don't have, and then I am sent on a mission. I will get those for you.
Now, did we talk about avocados yet?
Not yet.
I was sleeping for a few minutes back there.
Oh, well, you know, avocados go with absolutely
everything. Absolutely everything.
And Mexicans, we pride ourselves in that avocados originated in Mexico, and even the Hass, you know, which is the creamiest, the most buttery, the softest, the most gentle of avocados, thrives in Michoacán, which is a state in Mexico that has a lot of rainfall, and it has a lot of sun during the day, and then it gets cold at night, and avocado trees just love that. And most of the avocados that we get in the U.S. come from Michoacán, and they are just delicious. And we put them in soups as a garnish, in ceviches, in sandwiches and tortas, you know, for all sorts of antojos, enchiladas. There's just, I think we go through like 2 or 3 avocados in my house every day.
Oh, really?
Yes, we love avocados.
Oh, I'd be happy because I love avocados, too.
Yes, well, from smashing them on guacamole to pureeing them in a soup to doing a sweet smoothie with mango and yogurt and dates. There's just so much you can do with avocados.
The only thing I did once wrong was I made a dessert with avocado, and I don't know what went wrong, but it sure didn't taste very good. And my dinner guests just left the bowls with the avocado, and it solidified around their spoons. I have no idea what the worst
thing. Oh, no.
So I've never tried sweet. I don't know what happened. we finally come to, I don't want to skip over desserts. So, I mean, some of these desserts are very sophisticated. But you say drinks are very important in Mexico. And so you have a whole bunch of drink recipes.
Yes. I mean, from margaritas and crazy spins on martinis and the aguas frescas that you will find on every table. We don't just drink to drink. We drink because we think it pairs well with something, or beers go great with tacos, or a tequila goes great with a dish, or a special red wine concoction will go fantastically well with a salad. We just, there's so many different kinds of drinks, and I try to be very playful in my takes on the drinks in this book, because I see drinks, I'm a very slow sipper. I have a very low tolerance for alcohol, so I can only drink so much. So I try to make the drinks be an experience that you just want to take sip by sip. So I have like that grilled pineapple.
That's the one I'm looking at. It is so
beautiful. As you are sipping, you are munching on the candied caramelized chunks of grilled rustic pineapple, and you have the sweet and the sour and the spicy, and I just love combining flavors in a drink so that a drink is not merely a drink, but that it really becomes an experience that enhances your whole eating.
Well, this one is a knockout, the spiked pomegranate cocktail with Mexican chocolate, which is a whole other subject, and
that
star anise.
Is, yes.
Anyhow, we could go on for a long time with this, Patty, but I think that we have to wrap it up. Is there one thing in particular you'd like to leave in people's thoughts about the new Mexican cuisine?
Yes, I would love to tell people to just open up their doors and their minds and their eyes and to be open to try new things, because Mexican is really not what you think it is.
Right. I agree. So, you know, I've spent a fair amount of time there, and it's not what you think. It's not what a lot of people think. Anyhow, well, continued success, and also with this book, Mexican Today, and we're talking to Patty Ginich.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Patty.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's extended version of On the Menu Radio. We will be back with you same time, same place again next week. So we hope we'll see you then. And until then,
bye-bye.